This time of year is a time of increased anxiety and stress for many people. Many view this holiday as going from the slavery of Egypt to the slavery in the kitchen. And there is indeed a lot of work and preparation that goes into making Pesach. But at times, people are strict when it's not required, and sometimes just simply don't understand what's necessary. So here, as always, knowledge is power. And the more that you understand about the laws of Pesach, the better you'll be able to prepare and also hopefully stay calm. So let's review. We'll get right into it. Let's review and clarify the halachos of kashering your home and kitchen for Pesach. And so we could all get ready and be calm and prepare properly for this important holiday. The Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein, writes that on Pesach there are three positive commandments, mitzvah aseh, and four mitzvos lo taseh, four negative commandments. The three mitzvah aseh, positive commandments, are eating matzah the first night of Pesach. The second mitzvah aseh is Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, is relating the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, relating the story of the Exodus on the first night. And in diaspora, so we do these mitzvot of eating matzah and also relating the story on the second night as well, of course, at the Seder the second night. And the third positive commandment is called Tashbisu, and that's the mitzvah to eliminate chametz from our possessions on the morning prior to Pesach, on the 14th day of Nisan. Those are the three positive commandments when it comes to Pesach. The four mitzvot lo taseh, the four negative commandments, are as follows, and you have it in the sheet that we gave out. One is shelo le'echol chametz kol Pesach. You're not allowed to eat chametz all 7 days, 8 days in the diaspora. That, of course, includes bread, pasta, cereals, all different kinds of chametz. The second mitzvah lo taseh, the second prohibition, is that you're not allowed to eat tarovet chametz, any mixtures as well that include chametz. The third mitzvah lo taseh, the third prohibition, is called lo yira'eh. The pasuk says, lo yira'eh lecha se'or. It's a pasuk in Parshat Re'eh in Sefer Dvarim, which means that chametz should not be seen in your home. And the fourth mitzvah lo taseh is lo yimatzeh, shivat yamim lo yimatzeh, se'or lo yimatzeh bevatechem, that chametz should not be found in your home. Those last two that I just said are often known as Bal Yiroa Bal Yimatzeh. They're two very, very similar prohibitions, and they're often said together. And the Isser, the prohibition, is really not that it shouldn't be seen in your home, because if it's owned by somebody else, if it's owned by a non-Jew, so then you're really not in violation of the prohibition of Bal Yiroa Bal Yimatzeh. The prohibition of Bal Yiroa Bal Yimatzeh is really that you shouldn't be in ownership of chametz. In other words, that chametz that you own should not be seen or found in your home. And according to the Rambam, there's a fifth mitzvah lo taseh, there's a fifth prohibition, and that is shelo le'echol chametz, that you're not allowed to eat chametz even erev Pesach, the day before Pesach, after midday, after chatzot. And the rabbis added on a prohibition that we don't eat chametz after the fourth hour of the day, like two halachic hours prior to chatzot, we already stop eating chametz. And 1 hour prior to midday, we already stop benefiting from chametz, and that's when you have to finish burning the chametz. Okay, so really there's different times there in the morning where by 4 hours of the day, that's the last time to eat chametz on a rabbinic level. Then by the fifth hour, that's you can't benefit from chametz and you have to fully nullify it. We'll get back to that in a minute. And that's by the fifth hour, you have to complete the burning of the chametz. And by midday, midday, that's where there's a Torah prohibition, according to the Rambam, where you're not allowed to eat chametz already from midday. And of course, we don't own chametz anymore by that time, leading into Pesach. So with that foundation, so the question really that you could ask is that, you know, when it comes to most food prohibitions or many food prohibitions, you're not allowed to eat it, but you're allowed to benefit from it. Something like pork, which is, of course, you might say is like the classic paradigm of a non-kosher food. You're not allowed to eat pork, but technically speaking, you're allowed to benefit from it. Let's say if you have it, you can give it to a pet. Or you could, if you have it, you can give it to a non-Jew and benefit from it in that way. With regards to some prohibitions, let's say like basar v'chalev, like meat and milk, so then here it's a little more serious. You can't eat it. Of course, we don't eat a meat and milk mixture. You're not allowed to cook it. And you're also not allowed to benefit from it. There's three psukim in the Torah that says, let's say, lo tevashal gedi b'chalev imo. And the rabbis understood the three psukim to be referring to, you're not allowed to cook it, you're not allowed to benefit from it, and you're not allowed to eat it. The rabbis extended the prohibition of meat and milk to not having chicken and milk, but here it's just that you're not allowed to eat it. You're allowed to cook, actually. Let's say if a person's in culinary school or needs to cook it for some reason, you're actually allowed to cook, chicken and dairy, chicken and cheese. The rabbis extended the prohibition not to eat chicken and cheese because it could be confused with meat and milk, but they didn't extend the prohibition of cooking. But anyway, that's parenthetical. So with many food prohibitions, the prohibition is just not to eat, but you're allowed to benefit. Meat and milk, so you're not allowed to eat, you're not allowed to benefit, you're not allowed to cook. Chametz is even more serious. Number one, there's this mitzvah of tashbitu, that you have to kind of destroy it and eliminate it. And one classic way we do that is burning it on the day or the morning prior to Pesach. But the second thing is that we just mentioned that when it comes to chametz, you're not allowed to eat it, you're not allowed to benefit from it, and you're also not allowed to own chametz during Pesach. So the question is, why is chametz more serious? What is it about chametz that led the Torah to make this prohibition that's really unique against owning chametz? With regards to meat and milk, a cheeseburger, as I said, there's three prohibitions, but technically speaking, you're allowed to own, you're allowed to have it in your possession, you're allowed to own it, as long as you're going to be careful not to eat it or benefit from it. That's when it comes to meat and milk. But when it comes to chametz on Pesach, so here there's a prohibition not only of eating, of benefiting, but also of owning, and that's called bal yira bal yimatzeh, right? That it can't be found or seen in your possession. And what that means is that you really can't be in ownership of the chametz. So why is chametz different? Manishtana chametz from all the other prohibitions. The Ran, Rabbeinu Nisim of Spain, 13th, 14th century, gives two different explanations as to why you can't even own it, and why did the Torah go and was stringent to say you have to destroy it prior to Pesach. So two explanations. He says that when it comes to other non-kosher foods, they're prohibited all year long. So you familiarize yourself to avoiding those non-kosher foods. But with chametz, so it's permitted. Bread, cereal, cookies, these things are permitted all year long. And because it's you're accustomed to eating it, so that's why the Ran says the Torah needed to make an even more stringent prohibition to say that you need to eliminate it before Pesach actively, and that there's a special prohibition of bal yira bal yimatzeh, that you're not allowed to own the chametz as well. Why? Because you're familiar with it, you eat it all year long, and so the Torah wanted to make it more stringent to ensure compliance. The second explanation, he says, is that we see that chametz is a more stringent prohibition because if you eat chametz on Pesach, the Torah says that is a punishment of karet. Karet is like being cut off from the Jewish people. And so you see that chametz is more serious than other prohibitions. And there are other reasons that you can give for that. We're not going to go into now. And perhaps that's why the Ran says that along with that, that's why the Torah said that there's also a prohibition of owning chametz. With that, foundation, so the question now we can ask is, why must you clean your home for Pesach? Now, some of you might think that that's a strange question. What do you mean, why must you clean? Of course you have to clean your home for Pesach. Pesach is Pesach. But why do you have to clean your home for Pesach? So there's really three reasons why you have to clean your home for Pesach. The first one is because owning chametz is a prohibition and violation of bal yira bal yimatzeh. So that's why you have to clean and clear out the chametz. The second reason is that if chametz is lying around in the house, so then you might come and eat the chametz, which is, of course, something you don't want to do on Pesach. And the third reason why you have to prepare your home, and why we're having this shiur, is because of this mitzvah of tashbitu. Right, that it says Ach biyom arishon tashbitu su'or mibatechem, that on the first day, the rabbis understood that to be the day prior to Pesach, the morning prior to Pesach, tashbitu, you have to destroy. You have to search and destroy all the chametz in your possession. So for those three reasons, that's why, you know, kind of like one of these simple questions that, you know, wait a second, why do we have to clean our home for Pesach? The reason is because you can't own chametz. Number two, because if chametz is lying around, you might come and eat it. And number three, because of this mitzvah of tashbitu. Okay, so how do you then prepare your home? If now that we understand, you know, all the mitzvot relating to the holiday, we understand some of the nature, you know, the nature of the prohibitions and why we have to clean and prepare the home. So how does one prepare their home for Pesach? The good news is that you do not need to rip out your carpet. You don't need to replace the floor tiles. You don't need to blowtorch the curtains. Those are all things that you don't have to do in preparation for Pesach. Okay, and you don't have to engage in spring cleaning, cleaning out the garage and filing all the papers that you've been meaning to do for the last 10 years. What is one obligated to do? So let's streamline it and welcome Simone and Phyllis and the others who've joined online. So there are a few different mechanisms in this war, in this battle against chametz. The first one is the classic that... That the traditional method of clearing your home is by cleaning your home and then doing bedika and biur. Bedika's chametz, of course, is done the night prior to Pesach, which is this year is Sunday night. Right, it's the night of the 14th. It's a day before the Seder, and so we do bedika's chametz, and then biur we do Monday morning. Right, the morning prior to Pesach, we burn at least the remaining chametz that we have. We'll come back to that in a second. That's one mechanism, bedika and biur. The second mechanism is what's called bittul, nullification. And the third mechanism that we have is called mechirat chametz, selling your chametz. Okay, so let's go into and elaborate each one of these. Bedika and biur. Getting your home ready. So, like you do throughout the year, you sweep the floors, you vacuum the carpets. So that's, let's talk about what you don't have to do. Well, you said you don't have to blowtorch your curtains, you don't have to do things like that, but what should you do? So you should sweep the floors and vacuum the carpets, like you do occasionally all year long. If you're blessed to have a family member or a housekeeper who could help you out with these chores, of course, take advantage of that. Number two, check desk drawers quickly to make sure there's no Twix bars and other things that are there. Number three, check your jackets and coats, right, to check the pockets. You want to look at the backpacks and purses, just look through to make sure it's clear of cookies or any food items that are not kosher for Pesach. And one other thing that's a good thing to do is to check the cushions, like of the couch, check the cushions of the chairs, if you have cushioned chairs, to try to clear those out to the degree that you can. Those are the main places that you have to check and clear for Pesach.
What about the carpet?
You don't have to pick up the carpet. You don't have to, move all the fridge or the refrigerator, outside and clear behind the fridge or refrigerator. We'll get back to that. The halacha really is, and Rivka, I'll get your question. The halacha is that anywhere that chametz is generally brought, so you should clean and check, do that final check before Pesach as part of bedikas chametz. If it's a place where chametz is never brought, like a bathroom, so then there's no need to check. Or if it's in the garage, where you never bring chametz into the garage, God bless you, so then you don't need a check there. If there are children in the house, and the children are running all over the place, so then it's more challenging, because then they'll bring chametz anywhere all over the place. And so then, of course, there's kind of, you should try to check all the areas where chametz could possibly be brought. But the children should also be asked to help out, to check their desk drawers, to check their backpacks, to check their jacket pockets, to be involved, and you can make it a family experience, of course, in preparing the home. So that's, don't go overboard. If you bring chametz there, you should clear it out, labriut. But that's the classic traditional way of preparing the home. Together with that, together with this idea of clearing the home, which maybe will take, should take 1 to 2 hours. I'm not counting the sweeping and the vacuuming, because that you generally do. And again, hopefully you get the family members or housekeeper, if you're blessed to have a housekeeper, right, to be involved in doing some of these things. Certainly like you know, cleaning the floor and sweeping and vacuuming and doing basic cleaning. But there's a second mechanism, which is called bittul, which means nullification. On the night of Bedikas Chametz, after we do the Bedika, we say that any Chametz that we may not know about and that we didn't find should be nullified. On the morning, this year it's Monday morning, when we do the burning of the Chametz, again, we do it again. We do what's called bittul. Right, it's the paragraph that begins called Chamir v'Chamia Dika Bershusi, and we do the nullification again in the morning. The nullification in the morning is different in one subtle, significant way, which is we say any chametz that we don't know about, or even chametz that we do know about. Everything should be nullified on the night of the bedika, since we're doing the bedika. So that's why Chazal said, you know what, since you're doing the bedika, then that's why you should nullify it. And you only want to nullify the things that you don't know about, because you still have chametz there that you might plan to eat that night or in the morning before the end time of eating chametz. But then when you do bittul again, you do it two times. The second time, you do it for those things you don't know about and any chametz that you do know about. So with regards to crumbs, or things that you didn't find, or things that you didn't get to, that's where bittul plays a key role. The Gemara presents it that bittul actually could work and solve the whole problem. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, wait a second, if bittul, nullification of chametz, can work, so why not just do that? And this way you don't have to sweep the floors, you don't have to check the cushions, you don't have to check your jacket pockets, just do bittul. And the Gemara seems to suggest that bittul ba'al masagi, that actually nullification is so powerful and effective that really it does solve the problem on a Torah level. The Ran and the Rishonim give two different reasons why you don't want to just rely on bittul. Because that's number one, because bittul is a mental nullification that you're doing, and that's, you know, that's high stakes. That's a lot riding on just your intention. And that's the reason why we don't rely on bittul. We say, no, you still have to do bedika, you still have to clear the home, and you still have to do bedika and biur of the chametz, because we don't want to rely fully on this, on the mental cognition of nullifying chametz. You know, it's not so simple to nullify a Twix bar, or it's the second time mentioning Twix, you see what's my favorite chocolate bar, right? It's not so easy to nullify a loaf of chametz, you know, to nullify it. And the second reason why we don't want to rely on bittul alone is because, okay, bittul could work to nullify it, so it's not considered chametz, but then you might come, if it's just lying around, again, you might come and eat it. And if you come in, and if you're eating it, right, so that, of course, is going to be a terrible, serious violation of Pesach. So for those two reasons, that's why we generally don't rely only on bittul. But bittul is an important mechanism that's used in addition to the cleaning and preparing for Pesach. In other words, you're cleaning and preparing the home, wherever you're going to be. But the Torah wasn't given to angels. It was given to human beings. It's almost impossible to get every single crumb, wherever it might be. And that's why any crumbs that are inaccessible or any things that you didn't find, you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to stress over it, because all you have to do is bittul. How does bittul work? So the Rashi says that it actually is a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Tashbisu, because the pasuk doesn't say that you have to burn chametz. Then it should have said tevaru. It should have said b'yom harishon tevaru, that you should burn the chametz. From the fact that the Torah uses the word tashbitu, Rashi says, you see that on a Torah level, you can solve your problem not through burning, but even through mental nullification of the chametz. According to Rashi, bittul works by you're actually making it into like dust, you're making it into ashes, and you're fulfilling the mitzvah of tashbisu, which is one of the mitzvahs of Pesach, of eliminating the chametz prior to Pesach. According to Tosfos, Tosfos disagrees. Tosfos says, no, you're getting carried away. Tosfos says about how effective bittul is. According to Tosfos, it's really more of a workaround. That when you do bittul, essentially you're making it ownerless. You're making it hefker. By making it ownerless, oh, so it's not yours anymore. And then it's no longer a problem. Again, this is in addition to the cleaning and the bedikah and the beer that you're doing. So we do bittul in addition to that. And we actually incorporate Rashi and Tosfos in the formula that we say. We say, kol chamir v'chamiya dika b'shusi, any 11 products that are in our possession. We say, lahave hefker, ki afra diara. It should be ownerless, like dirt and the dirt of the land. Why do we use those both of those expressions? The reason is to fulfill the explanation of Tosfot and that of Rashi. So we say lahavi hefker, it should be ownerless. That's in accordance with the position of Tosfot, that when you nullify something, when you nullify the crumbs or the chametz, you're making it ownerless. It's no longer in your possession, and therefore it's not a problem. And according to Rashi, no, you're actually making it like the dirt of the land, and you're destroying it. You might not be physically destroying it, but you're mentally, intellectually destroying it, and you're actually fulfilling tashbisu. So we incorporate both of those in the formula of bittul. The third mechanism, aside from bedika / biur, which is the classic cleaning of the house, you have this, and aside from bittul, which is a crucial mechanism to ease your anxieties, to ease the stress. You could rely on bittul. You're okay with the crumbs. And number three is mechirat chametz. The third mechanism is mechirat chametz. And some are stringent to not sell actual chametz. They'll only sell food products that have maybe a little bit of chametz in them. The widespread custom is lenient, is not like that. In other words, the widespread custom is that you could sell any types of chametz you want. You could sell a full-fledged loaf of bread that's bona fide gesunte chametz. The widespread custom is what you do is that you could sell it to a non-Jew, and the common custom, as you know, is you go to the rabbi, you appoint the rabbi. You're not selling your chametz to the rabbi. Rather, you're appointing the rabbi to be your agent to sell your chametz, any chametz that you've designated on your behalf, to the non-Jew. And what you do is you do a kinyan. The kinyan strengthens, right? You lift the pen or you lift the handkerchief, and that strengthens the fact that you're appointing the rabbi to sell the chametz for you. So what you do is you any items, in other words, any items that you're not clearing out of your home, and also big items, which is really not relevant to nullify, you know, big items or boxes of pasta or things like that. And you should try to monitor it in the weeks leading up to Pesach to not buy 10 boxes of pasta 2 weeks before Pesach, or to buy 4 boxes of Fiber One cereal, you know, a week before Pesach. So you should, you know, try to schedule it and calculate in advance. But certainly when it comes to whiskey and other things of chametz, aside from clearing it out, bedikah biur, and aside from bittul, so here this is a key mechanism in our war against chametz, which is that what you do is you put it into a designated area, you tape up those cabinets, and those items are sold through the rabbi, it's sold to the non-Jew, prior to Pesach, of course. Now, so these are the key ways of preparing your home for Pesach, and hopefully we have a game plan, right, with understanding the prohibitions, understanding what you don't have to do, what you're obligated to do, and I don't know, it depends on how big your house is. I guess, you know, I was once called to check some mezuzahs, and it was a home in North Beverly Hills, and it took me 4 hours to figure out how many mezuzahs and where the mezuzahs are required. So I guess for a home, for a very, very big home, so maybe it takes longer to prepare the home. That's right, that's one of the reasons why you don't have to have a big home. It's easier to prepare for Pesach, but it hopefully shouldn't take that long. it should take a just to prepare the home for Pesach. I'm not talking about the kitchen. I'm not talking about the shopping and the cooking. Yes, there's certainly a lot of work that goes into making Pesach with the shopping and the cooking and then all the meals and even preparing the home in the kitchen. But in terms of preparing the home, hopefully with these three mechanisms, you have a game plan of doing it without getting carried away. Let's take a pause for a second if anyone has any questions. Yeah. Rivka, go ahead. Yes, we actually, there will be a community burning of the chametz, and stay tuned for the details. I think it is going to be. We'll let you know. We'll let you know by Shavuos. We'll let you know when where the beer. No, I'm just kidding. We'll send out a note. I was notified that they are arranging a community burning of chametz, and I think by the Yula Girls High School again on Key Street. But we'll send you the information. Yeah, Isaac. Yeah.
After,
so that's great.
Can you then go home, because you're still before the time where you have to get rid of everything, can you still eat, the chametz that may be left?
Yeah, as long as it's before the deadline of eating chametz.
No, I understand that, but if you burn
you burn the chametz already. Then you really, you should do that after. You should do that at the end. Uh-huh. Yeah, you should finish eating your chametz. Have the muffin, have the donut or the cereal prior, then you go burn the chametz. Okay, any questions from online? Yes, Simone.
Hi. So the thing where you hide the bread and then go find it with like the feather and all that, is that halacha, or is that just like a minhag or something that we do with the kids, or is it real and we should be doing
okay, I'm so glad you're asking that, because I mentioned it, that's bedikah, but I didn't really spend that much time on it. That's a very important mitzvah. It's usually assumed to be a rabbinic mitzvah, but it's leading to the Torah mitzvah of clearing out your home for Pesach. And so, is it a Torah mitzvah, is it a rabbinic mitzvah? But bedikas chametz is a very, very important mitzvah that we do in preparing for Pesach. And we do that on the night before the holiday. This year it's Sunday night. And what you do, it's a custom to put out the pieces of bread. You don't really have to do that. And certainly some people, what they do is they just put out the 10 pieces of bread, and then that's all they do. They just look for the 10 pieces of bread. The idea is that by putting out the 10 pieces of bread, which is more of a Kabbalistic concept, it's a widespread custom to put out the 10 pieces of bread. Here at Beit Jacob, we're selling these very creative kits for kids and families that Robin and Rabbi Broner, I think, put together. But the idea of putting out the bread is really to just ensure that you're going to make sure to look around the house. And so that's a very important mitzvah that we do on the night before Pesach. And then you take that bread that you've collected and also any other remaining bread or chametz, and you burn that the next morning. So and you use a candle, and it's a good idea to also use the flashlights. And you should try to make sure to give yourself some time to really go around the house. And that's not supposed to be the first time, of course, that we start cleaning the house. That's kind of like the final review. Final review, like on the computer, are you sure? So this is, are you sure that the home is clear? And so it's not supposed to be perfunctory or ceremonial. It's supposed to be like a real search, but it's like the final review of the house to make sure everything is clear.
Okay, thank you.
Let's move now from the home into the kitchen. With regards to the kitchen, so of course, any foods that you eat over Pesach need to be kosher le Pesach, so you have to make sure that they're not chametz and they're purchased from a grocery or whatever, that it has a kosher Pesach symbol. Not only that, but the pots, the pans, the silverware, the dishes also need to be kosher for Pesach. I'm not going to tell the story, but about the royal banquet that took place in Vancouver that involved Rabbi Heyer, where he had his kosher dishes. In any way, Prince Charles was surprised to learn that when it comes to Jews, we don't only eat kosher, but we need to have kosher dishes as well. And with regards to Pesach, that's the case, because you're not allowed to eat chametz, but you're also not allowed to eat or benefit from the taste of chametz that may be found in the walls of the utensil, that might be found in the spoon or the fork itself. Regarding utensils and silverware, if you have specially designated kosher for Pesach silverware, so then you're good to go. Regarding the silverware or pots and pans that you want to kosher, and also appliances that you use all year long that you may want to kosher for Pesach, so let's review some of the rules about koshering. And here at Beth Jacob, we have a morning of koshering. I think we're doing that. That's April 14th, a Sunday morning, where you could bring your pots and pans and silverware and kosot here to do the koshering at Beth Jacob. But let's review some of the basic laws of koshering, and then we'll apply it to the kitchen in a step-by-step fashion. The pasuk in Bamidbar, Perek Lamed Aleph, pasuk Chaf Bet, says, Kol davar, you have it on your sheet in the middle, Kol davar asher yovo ba'esh, tavir ba'esh. This was in the aftermath of their war against Midian, and they suddenly had all these pots and pans and silver dishes. So it says that anything that is used through fire has to be purged and kashered through fire. V'chol asher lo yovo ba'esh, and anything that's not used through fire, taviru b'mayim, you should purge it and kasher it through water. What does this mean? What this means, this is teaching us the concept of kabolo kach polto. If you want to impress your religious family members over Pesach, you can say you kashered everything in accordance with the principle of kabolo kach polto. Of course, you're also a religious family member, but if you want to impress, right, kabolo kach polto means as a pot absorbs the taste of chametz or not kosher, that's the way to remove the taste. In the same way, in the same medium that it absorbed the problematic taste, that's the way you remove it. So what does this mean in practical terms? Let's say if you have a pan or grill that's used for food without the medium of water, so then it's used kind of through fire. It's like a grill grate. So then the only way you're going to be able to kosher that is through fire, which is called libun. If you have a pot or a pan that's used for food with the medium of water, it has sauce or it has water that you use with it, so then it requires what's called hagala, koshering through boiling water. And another principle, let's say, or another application of this is if you have a countertop or you have a sink, so here, any problematic ingredient, it fell on it, right? Where you put some chametz on it during the course of the year. And a lot of the rules of koshering utensils is for Pesach, but also, let's say, if something becomes not kosher accidentally, so how do you kosher it? But we're focusing, of course, on Pesach. But if you have a countertop or a sink that's poured upon, the way to remove the chametz taste is by pouring boiling water over it. That's called irui rotchin. So you have it on your sheet. You have libun is number one. Number two is hagala. Number three is irui rotchin. So that's kind of three applications of this principle of kabolo kach polto. Kind of to give you a framework, not answering all the questions, but why does a particular utensil need a specific method of koshering? Okay, so it depends. If it's used by fire, without water, that's going to be tougher. You're going to need to use a blowtorch, or it's going to need like red hot heat of libun. If it's used with water, and that's most of the times there's water involved in some way, so then we do hagala, we immerse it into boiling water, and that's what we're going to be focusing on in terms of koshering. And the third way is through if it's like a sink or a countertop, so then you pour, right? The way to kosher it is by pouring boiling water over it. We're going to explain a little bit more details about all those three things, especially the hagala, which is the main way of kashrik. But before we get into more specifics, which materials can be kashered and which materials cannot be kashered? So here, the Shulchan Aruch, Siman Taf Nun Aleph, says that any items that are kli'eitz, the even umateket. If it's a wood utensil, so it can, you're allowed to kasher that through hagala, through boiling water. If it's stone, let's say like granite or marble, that also, right, you can kasher that through boiling water, through hagala. And the third thing is mateket, that's metal utensils, so that's, right, the silverware, the pots, the pans, and things of that nature, so that all could be kashered through hagala. We'll talk about the different steps of hagala in a moment. What about earthenware? So here, as many of you know, there's a leniency when it comes to earthenware and a stringency when it comes to earthenware. So this is good if you have a couple gets married and they get a china. So according to most poskim, my understanding is that they do not need to tovel that in a mikvah. Okay, that's something also. We're not going to really talk much about toveling, but if you buy a new item, it kind of has to be, if it was manufactured by a non-Jew, if you buy it from an Israeli company that's different, or a Jewishly owned company that's different, then you're fine. But if it's manufactured by a non-Jew, it kind of needs to be converted. And the way you do that, how does somebody convert? They go to the mikvah. Similarly, you have to bring a new pot, anything that's metal or glass. Metal or glass, you have to bring to the mikvah. And this is one of the things. You get to the Kela mikvah, and of course it's closed, right? Because that's the rule. It's always closed when you get there. No, I'm just kidding. It often seems to be closed, and then you got to go back a second time and a third time. But hopefully you'll get to tovel it on the first time. But any metal or glass needs to be toveled in a mikvah. China. I'm not talking about the country now. I'm talking about China dishes. The leniency when it comes to China is you do not need to tovel that in a mikvah. You buy it from Mikasa or wherever people buy China, and you're good to go. It wasn't used for anything, so there's no not kosher in there. It doesn't need to be koshered. And it doesn't need to be toveled in a mikvah, as I said, because it's called kli cheres. It's earthenware of China. It doesn't need to be toveled in a mikvah. The stringency by earthenware, however, is that if it becomes not kosher, generally speaking, You can't kasher. You cannot kasher kli cheres, earthenware, or china. Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Igros Moshe, has a tshuva where it was a certain balei tshuva, and they were trying to make their kitchen kosher, and he felt in the extenuating circumstances that they could wait a year, because there's one opinion that says if you wait a year, it's okay, and then you could kasher through boiling water. We don't rely on that. But Rav Moshe felt in that extenuating case, to enable them to make their kitchen kosher, and they were just becoming from religious or observant. And so he said you could wait a year and you could do Hagala three times, because there's one opinion that says that when the halacha says that you can't kasher earthenware or china, that means to do it one time. But if you do it three times, so then it's doing it three times, and that's going to work even for china. Again, we don't follow that opinion either. But Rav Moshe felt in certain situations, in extenuating circumstances, you could combine those two opinions, say you wait a year and you do Hagala three times, that will kasher. I've actually passed this for people moving into an apartment. They have a dishwasher, and let's say it's porcelain walls. So if they wait a year and they run it through the cycle, you know, three times, so perhaps is what to rely on to say that that's in an extenuating case and it would be a very, very significant expense that you can't afford to get a new dishwasher. And half-jokingly, I'm saying it's hard to survive without a dishwasher. Okay, so perhaps three times you wait a year. But in general, or another example, let's say you've like a very expensive family heirloom, you know, or a china dish, and you use it every yontif or whatever it is, and it becomes not kosher by accident. By accident, somebody put the dairy onto the meat, the china dish. And this is this is passed from generation to generation to generation. And it's a very expensive dish. Okay, so ask a shaila, because it could be that you don't have to throw it out, based on that leniency of Rav Moshe Feinstein. But in general,
Another exception is like if you put it into a kiln at a very, very high temperature, but who knows if it's going to survive the kiln. The general rule is when it comes to a china dish, if it becomes not kosher, you throw it out because you can't kasher it. The leniency is you don't have to tovel it, but the stringency is that you can't kasher it. And the same thing is for Pesach. We generally don't kasher china for Pesach. You want to have china, you want to use china on Pesach, wonderful, but it should be, of course, you know, bought and used just for Pesach. What about glass? So glass is interesting. Glass, you do have to tovel glass, as I mentioned, in a mikvah. With regards to glass, there's a major debate between Sfardim and Ashkenazim, or between the Mechaber and Ramah in the Shulchan Aruch. Rav Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch says that when it comes to glass items, that it can't become treif. Can't become treif, can't become chametz stick, and you don't even have to kasher it. You wash it, make sure it's clean, and you use it on Pesach. And I believe there's some Sfardim that rely on that. The Ramah and Ashkenazic practice is that not only do we say that it's not true that it doesn't need to be kashered, but you can't kasher it. So it's the other extreme. And that's our general practice. Ashkenazic practice is that we don't kasher glass. You know that you have a special, you know, kosher Pesach glasses, but we don't take our glasses from during the year and kasher that. Okay, we kasher metal. You can kasher stone, as we said. You can kasher wood, but we don't kasher earthenware. You know, china. We don't or cannot, according to Ashkenazic practice, we don't kasher glass. And what about one other important detail when it comes to, let's say, wood, is that the Mishnah Berurah says that it has to be something smooth. Because if it has like cracks or nooks and crannies, so then you're not going to be able to clean it out. If you can't clean it, so then you're not going to be able to kasher it. Kashering kind of presupposes, a precondition of kashering is cleaning, as we'll get back to in a second. So if you have a wood item, you can throw that into boiling water and kasher it that way. But that's kind of assuming that it's kind of a smooth wood utensil. So all metals can be kashered, smooth wood utensil, granite or marble countertops, and things of that nature. All those can be kashered. What about plastic? So this is a major, major debate regarding plastic. The Minchas Yitzchak, Diane Weiss, permits kashering plastic. And that's a very important psak when it comes to if you have a microwave that has plastic walls and other things that are plastic. And I heard this psak many years ago from Rabbi Neuberger, that you're allowed to kasher plastic. In other words, it's similar to metal in that group of things that can be kashered and should be kashered if you want to use it for Pesach. The Igros Moshe or Moshe Feinstein, however, paskins that you cannot kasher plastic, and that it's, you know, similar to china, similar to kli cheres, that you cannot kasher. And when I asked Rabbi Willig paskined that it's better to be machmir. So I'm presenting to you two opinions. There are some poskim that say that are lenient about it. There are many poskim that say you should be stringent not to kasher plastic. So it's two different opinions when it comes to plastic. Now that we understand a framework of, you know, some of the different methods of kashering, and we kind of have a knowledge, right, kind of a crash course knowledge of the different materials, what can be kashered, what cannot be kashered. And glasses, by the way, the Mishnah Berurah says that by glasses, let's say a person just, they don't have any glasses. It's just one set of glasses. So the Mishnah Berurah says, and I think you could rely on this, I believe, let's say if the glasses were just used for cold during the year, although who knows how they were washed, and they were washed with other chametzik utensils, but let's say it's used for cold during the year, and if and when it was washed with soap, so... So then, again, it's better not to kasher glass. But if kind of extenuating case and you don't have any other glasses, the Mishnah Berurah says you could do what's called milui v'irui three times. Part of the reason why I'm mentioning this is because it's a cool other way of kashering. We generally don't do this. But when it comes to glass and you need a kasherit, extenuating case, you do what's called, this is number four on the sheet, milu v'irui. What you do is you fill up the glasses, or you, let's say you put it in a bathtub of water, you leave it there for 24 hours. Then you empty out the water after 24 hours, and you put in another, right, and you fill it up with water, and it sits in the water for another 24 hours, and you do that again a third time. It's called milui v'irui, kind of like filling and pouring out three times, each one 24 hours. So that's a way to kosher glass. Again, we usually don't do that, but I figured I would just mention, because that the Mishnah Berurah says it, then it's a cool other way of koshering. Again, if you need glasses in a pinch, especially if it was used just for cold. So, what boiling water, koshering, okay? Of course, a great method, you want to come to Beth Jacob. It's always a good idea to come to Beth Jacob. Okay, good things happen at Beth Jacob. You see good people, and it's always nice to come to the shul. But a little secret that I'm going to share with all of you is that it's really not difficult to kosher utensils. And although you might need like a big pot, and it could get a little messy, and that's why it's great. Come to the shul to do your koshering. We'd love to do it all for you. But it's really not that complicated. And so over the course of the year, if something becomes not kosher, so you can usually kosher it. Again, if it's metal or wood or it's the countertop or something, you could or the sink, you could kosher it. And certainly in preparing for Pesach, you can kosher it. What are the different steps of koshering? So there's four steps of koshering through the form of hagala, of boiling water. Okay? The first step is you need to clean the item thoroughly. Okay? Remember we said that if there's like a nook and cranny or cracks, then you can't kosher because you can't clean it. So the first step in koshering is typically you need to clean it thoroughly. The second step is you need to usually wait 24 hours before koshering it. The reason for that is because, let's say you have a non-kosher item or you have a chametz stick utensil, so you fill it up with boiling water, what happens? The taste comes out of the wall into the water, but what's preventing it from going back into the wall? You ever wonder about that? So one of the ways we avoid that problem is by, if you've waited 24 hours, so let's say you put a spoon, a milchik spoon by accident, I'm talking about all year round now, right? You put a milchik spoon into the chicken soup by accident. The soup's going to be kosher because the soup is 60 times the amount of the spoon. So it's batel b'shishim. Another reason is if the spoon wasn't used in the last 24 hours, that's another reason why the soup or the cholent or whatever it is going to be kosher. But you need to kosher the spoon. Okay, so if you take a milchik spoon and you put it into the chicken soup's going to be fine, and the pot's going to be fine, but you need to kosher the spoon. So what do? You put it aside, and you try to avoid what happens to most people, which is that the spoon is put back into the drawer, and then you don't know which spoon it is. So what you do is you put it aside, you put it in a paper towel, you put it aside. You wait, you clean it off thoroughly in like the bathroom sink. You wait 24 hours. And the reason to wait the 24 hours, again, is that anything that comes, so then any taste in there after 24 hours, halachically speaking, is viewed as like a negative, spoiled taste. From a halachic perspective, right, it's called nosin tam lefgam, and that's why you wait 24 hours. Okay, so the first step is clean it thoroughly. The second step is you wait 24 hours. Third is you immerse it into the boiling water. You could use any pot for koshering. As long as it wasn't used in the last 24 hours, you could use any pot to kosher utensils. Kosher for Pesach, not kosher, but you could use any pot. Okay, clean that wasn't used for 24 hours. And the fourth step, okay, again, if you've cleaned it, you waited 24 hours, you put it in the boiling water, which is the key step. The fourth step is after you take it out of the boiling water, and of course, it goes without saying that you should be careful when you're dealing with the boiling water, and you don't want to put your hand into the boiling water directly, obviously. But when you take the item out carefully,
So then you're supposed to rinse, the custom is to rinse it in cold water as the final step. Now that we know the different concepts of kashering and methods and which materials can be kashered and those four steps, okay, now it should be, now let's apply it to some of the different things in the kitchen. So when it comes to silverware, pots and pans, okay, so you clean it, you wait the 24 hours, and you put it and you throw it into the boiling water. You rinse it at the end and you're good to go. With regards to an oven, your oven, if it's a self-cleaning oven, so then that's considered actually libun, that's a higher form of kashering, and you run it through one self-cleaning cycle, it should be clean, everything is burned out, and then that's a way to kasher the oven for Pesach. For a regular oven where you don't have the self-cleaning cycle, and also you have to be careful, sometimes self-cleaning cycles break the oven, and I've heard stories, this happened to us once. So how do you kasher the oven? See here, it's interesting, even though you don't use it with water, but you're not putting the food directly onto the grates or onto the wall of the oven. It's really the steam that makes the oven not kosher for Pesach, right? So it's the steam that we have to somehow clear out. So for this reason, we usually assume that you do the following. You clean it thoroughly, with an oven cleaner like Easy Off. The rack should be cleaned well. Again, right? So the oven should not be used for 24 hours. And then you set the oven. Okay, there is an opinion that says, no, you gotta use a libun, you gotta use a blowtorch. However, I think the majority opinion and what I've always relied upon is the position that you don't have to use libun. What you do is, you rely on kabolo kach polto. Remember that principle? Kabolo kach polto means that as it absorbs, that's how you extract. So what you do is you set it to the highest temperature for an hour, and you run the oven for an hour. That's considered an application of the principle of kabolo kach polto. That's, you set it to the highest temperature. You've cleaned it. You waited 24 hours. You ran it for 1 hour without anything in it, of course. And that will kasher your oven. It's very easy. Okay, again, the cleaning of the oven with the Easy Off, that takes time. Again, if you're zocha to a housekeeper or somebody to do it for you, go for it. Microwave. Well, so if you could survive Yantif without a microwave, you know, this way you could survive, you don't need it for chalamoid or whatever, so then close off the microwave. But if you want to use the microwave, and if it's plastic walls, and you want to rely on that position that you can kasher plastic. So, and also you're not really putting the things directly on the plastic, so that's another reason maybe to be lenient. So what you do is you clean it well, you don't use it for 24 hours, and you put a styrofoam cup or something like that, and you run it for 10 minutes. After the 10 minutes, take out the cup, and you fill it again, and you put it in a different spot. So this way the spot where the first cup was on will also be kashered. I heard that from Rav Schechter, to put it in an additional spot, and you run it for another 10 minutes. Be careful, of course, when you're removing the water. And with regards to the tray, you can either, you know, the tray is glass. Remember we said that you don't kasher glass. So either, you know, you could either remove the tray, or if you cover that well, you know, you wrap it well, either replace it or remove the tray, or you cover the tray very well with a saran wrap or something like that, and that should be good to kasher your microwave. Warming drawers, it's the heat setting doesn't go high enough, and best not to kasher those and not to use those on Pesach. You just kind of close those off for Pesach. How does one kasher the stovetop? For a conventional gas range, so the iron or metal grates can be kashered. What you do is cover them with a blech, you know, or like some sheet of metal or a pot of water. The idea of doing that is that kind of helps the heat reach a high level, kind of helps contain the heat. So you're kind of covering over the grate with a pot of water, and you turn the burners on the highest setting. Rabbi Willick told me to put it on for a half hour. I've heard over the years, you know, maybe even less. When I pressed Rabbi Willick, he said, okay, you want to do it for less. But, you know, for at least, you know, 15, 20 minutes or a half hour, do two at a time. That's just because, just to make sure, I've heard that if you put all four burners on at a time or all six burners on at a time, that could ruin the oven. So that's not a halachic reason, but perhaps it's a good idea practically to do two burners at a time. Now, the burners themselves do not need to be kosher, just cleaned. The area between the burners should be cleaned and covered with aluminum foil, or just, you know, make sure not to put anything down there. And then the grate is kosher. It, again, the grate was cleaned, and you waited 24 hours. You might not even need to wait 24 hours because this is libun; it's burning it out. But in any case, you're putting it on for at least 20 minutes, half hour. That's koshering the grates of the stovetop. Yeah. It's the blech or the water in the pot. That, and that's just to really contain the heat. This way it's kind of really containing the heat. As the heat comes, as the fire is burning the grate, is koshering the grate, you could put either a blech on top or just put a pot, a clean pot that hasn't been used in 24 hours, and you fill that with water. And that's really just acting to contain the heat. And then, of course, you can use that pot with boiling water to then kosher other things if you want.
Can you do it at the same time?
You could do it at the same time. You could do it at the same time. Yeah, Sarah.
I had two questions. One is, when does everything need to be totally koshered by?
Great question. Totally koshered by the morning of before Pesach, by the end of the fifth hour. And really, yeah, you don't want to cut it too close. So you probably better to do it the night before.
Really?
Probably do better to do it the night before.
Sunday.
Yeah, to do it to finish everything by Sunday night. But technically speaking, you could do it as long as by the end of the fifth hour.
But you can't have used it for 24 hours.
Right.
So really, it should be before Shabbat?
Or? Well, the koshering itself should be completed by Monday morning, the fourth or fifth hour. But that's right. You have to keep in mind, you need to wait 24 hours before doing the koshering. So just
right. However
you calculate it.
Okay. And then my second question was, I might have missed this part. Can you kosher your pots and pans at home, and that would be with fire or with water?
So that's with water. You could put, now you just need a pot big enough
to dip.
Okay, there's two. This is good. A very, very good question. We said that there's four steps, right? We said there's four steps. The third and most important step was immersing it into boiling water. Now, two things. Number one, when it comes to dipping in the mikvah, toveling, you got to put it in the mikvah all at once. When it comes to koshering is different. Koshering can be done in stages. So if you can't fit the item totally in the pot, you could put part of it, and then you could roll it around a little bit and put part of it, and roll around and put part of it. And it just needs to be in the boiling water for a few seconds, 5 seconds. Just a very, very short period of time. And you roll it around. The other thing is that if it's a big pot and you can't fit it into another pot, so then what you could do is you could just kosher it itself. You put the boiling water all the way to the top. When I say boiling water, it means you put water in there, you bring it to a boil, and if you bring it all the way to the top, one way to do it is you drop something hot in there, a hot stone. The other way to do it is just simply you put the water all the way to the top, and then the water will boil over the sides, and that koshers the pot. Again, you cleaned it first, you waited 24 hours, then you either immerse it into boiling water, and that can be done in stages, as I said, or number two, you put boiling water in it and let it go over the sides. If we could hold off just the questions for a few more minutes, and then we'll get time for questions, because maybe I'll even cover it. we covered, therefore, Simona, we'll get your question. So silverware, pots and pans, we covered. Ovens, self-cleaning ovens, microwaves, warming drawers, stovetops. Now, if you have like an electric stovetop, this gets trickier. The way you want to do that there is to clean the burners, turn them on the highest setting, red hot, for 10 minutes. The drip pans just need to be cleaned. And the area in the middle should be covered. If you have like a glass or one of these Saran smooth top range, so it's like electric and it's a smooth top, this is even harder. But what you do is, again, clean, don't use it for 24 hours, you put on the burners for 10 minutes to get it to a glow, and you put like, if you can, to put like a little disc on the area of the burner so that the pot is going on the disc, a disc, a quarter, something like that, so you're putting the pot on top of that. And the rest of the area, now if you could pour boiling water over it, you do that. But be careful before doing that, make sure that that's not going to ruin the stovetop. So if it's possible, you pour boiling water over it. Or if you can't do that, do what I said, just bring it to the highest temperature and place trivets on the area in the middle if you want to place the pot down in any of the areas between the burners. Now, sinks, how do you deal with sinks? If it's china or porcelain walls, those cannot be kashered and you need an insert. If it's a stainless steel sink, so then you could kosher that. Of course, if you want to have an insert, you can have an insert. I once had somebody call me and say, Rabbi, can I kosher my stainless steel sink? I said, yes, and here's how you do it. No, but really, I always thought you need an insert. I said, if you want, you could have an insert, but if you want, you could kosher it in such and such a way, and here are the steps. No, but Rabbi, really, like you know, but I think you really, don't you really need it? I said, Sarah, whatever her name is, it's not important. In a Sarah, if you want to use an insert, gezuntahit, you could use an insert. And of course, people often are very stringent when it comes to Pesach. It shows your enthusiasm, your love for the holiday. And to a point, if you want to be stringent, of course, that's wonderful. Of course, don't get carried away to an extent where it makes it hard to prepare for the holiday or observe the holiday. But when it comes to a stainless steel sink, so what you do is, again, you need to wait those 24 hours. So that's a little tricky. That's a little tricky with the sink. You have to wait 24 hours to not use any hot water in that sink. And then what you do is, and it's clean. Those are those first two steps. And here what we say, kabolo kach polto. Again, as it absorbs, that's the way you extract the taste. So what you do is you pour boiling water over the entirety of the surface of the sink. After koshering, then you just rinse it with cold water. With regards to the countertop, and look, if you want an insert, then use an insert for the sink. What about the countertops? A lot of people feel better about covering the countertops. That's the Pesach spirit, so go ahead and cover them. If you have a granite or marble or stainless steel, I don't know how many people have stainless steel, whatever, but if you have those kinds of countertops, so then you could use boiling water to kosher it. Again, you make sure you don't put any hot food on there for 24 hours. Usually you don't put hot food directly on the countertops. So it's interesting, countertop is really not a serious concern because the chametz sticker stuff doesn't go hot directly on there, and when it's Pesach, you're not putting really stuff directly on there, but the minhag certainly is to either cover or kosher the countertops for Pesach. If you want to kosher the counter, so what you do is you pour boiling water over it. The other way to do it, because and that's it's messy to pour the boiling water. You have to have a lot of towels ready to go. And maybe a good idea that you don't have, you know, all the family that's visiting, you know, kind of like watching as if, you know, they're watching at the zoo, watching you try to kosher all the counters with this boiling water going all over the place. So another method is you can steam. If you have one of these really high-powered steamers, and so the poskim say that that's another method. If you go slowly and you steam the counter, that would be another way to kasher the counter. Again, a lot of people feel better about covering it, not covering it, than boiling water to kasher it. But you could also do the steaming is another method. If it's a porcelain or enamel or silestone countertop, if it's one of those, that should be covered because you're not able to kasher. You're not able to kasher those. Hold on 1 second. Tablecloths and napkins. Tablecloths and napkins, just launder. Okay, you're not allowed to launder money, but you're allowed to launder tablecloths and napkins. So you just launder them and they're good to go for tablecloths and napkins. A high chair, clean it thoroughly, then cover the tray with some kind of contact paper or the like. KitchenAid and mixers and blenders, really those should be stored away with the chametz utensils, because it's really difficult to clean all the small parts of those mixers and things of that nature. The refrigerator, clean it thoroughly. I think it's better to not leave real chametz. Let's say you want to sell chametz. I think it's better to not leave real chametz in the fridge or the freezer. But look, if you have chametz and you have tinfoil over it and it's clearly marked and and there's no way you can get to it, then you could, technically speaking, include that in the mechira. It's better if you can, I think, to not have any chametz products in the fridge or the freezer. What you do is, to make it Pesach dik, you clean it, and the minig is to line the shelves. Okay, I don't think you need to move out the refrigerator or the wall unit or the dresser. You want to do that from time to time, every few years, just to clean it. But for Pesach purposes, I don't think you need to move it. It's inaccessible. Any crumbs there are not edible. You're doing bittel, remember? You're able to do bittel, so that solves that problem. I don't think you need to move out the refrigerator. Kiddush cups, the custom is, even though it's used for cold, the custom is to kasher those, because often those are washed with the chametz sticky utensils during the year. So what you do, if you want to use kiddush cups on Pesach, so you do hagala in boiling water. Silverware, we said it's hagala. And that's basically, that covers most of the different items. Toaster, George Foreman grills, pasta makers, bread machines, crock pots, all those things. Very difficult to kasher, and I would put those away with the chametz utensils. That, I think, covers most of it. So let's give some time for comments or questions. Happy to open it up. Simone, you had a question. Okay, while Simone is unmuting. Yeah.
Well, you have a skin that's porcelain. So you have the liner. Are you supposed to cover the sink in aluminum?
So you have the liner, meaning like you have an insert?
Insert.
And so everything goes in the insert. So I don't think you need to cover the sink. Because, again, it's clean. And the only concern, really, I guess, if it's hot water, that's what's going to fill up the sink. But anyways, you try not to let anything fill up. You have your insert in there, so I don't think you need a. Right, the water would drain. But I'm saying, and then the water is not kind of filling up in the sink. So that you try to make sure that the water just doesn't fill up. But otherwise, I don't see a reason to have to cover the sink. Because you have the insert. Okay, yeah, Marilyn, you're on mute.
The last few years, you were a little bit lenient with the dishwasher because it's very difficult for me to wash all the dishes. Well, my guests are insistent on using China all the time. If we do multiple cycles, can we use the dishwasher?
Okay, thanks for mentioning the dishwasher. Yeah, I might not have mentioned dishwasher. So if it has stainless steel walls, although the racks usually have some plastic on them, but I think if it has stainless steel walls, you wait the 24 hours, and according to Rabbi Willig, you run it through two cycles. I think I might have told you that, and I'll say that again, that if you could survive Pesach without the dishwasher, then do that. But if that's a hardship, and you want to be able to use the dishwasher, run it through two cycles, one with soap, and one without soap, and with nothing in it. Try to clean it, to the degree that you can. If you go down to the bottom, try to clean that area of the drain at the bottom of the dishwasher. And if the racks are otherwise smooth, then I think it would be okay to kasher the dishwasher in that way. You do it two times, one with soap and one without soap. If
Thank
it's a
you.
Porcelain.
And that's quickly the blender that has never had any pomades in it, and I get a new container for the top. Is that okay? A new top and a lid, so the food, I would just clean the bottom and then an urn, like a hot water urn.
Yeah, hot water urn, just pour boiling water over the spout. That should be sufficient. With regards to the blender, so then if there was no chametz used for it, are you sure that there was nothing chametz stick that was used for it? And also in terms of washing?
I'm sure of that, but I would get a new container.
What about the blades?
I would get all that. What I would get new, I would just be using the bottom machine.
That's fine. That's fine. That's fine. If you have a new container and new blades, that's fine to use the bottom machine.
Thank
you. Yeah. You're just clearing your throat. Okay. So, great. Hopefully that explained most things. Yeah, Rivka has a question. Yeah, medicine and cosmetics. So that's, I put that on the sheet here. There's really two schools of thought when it comes to medicines and cosmetics. There is a stringent position, and you have books about this, which is that if there's any chametz in the medicine or in the cosmetic, that you should avoid using it. And that's why you have these books that are that you have that show you what has no chametz in it. But I believe the majority opinion and the position of the OU, which is that anything inedible is by definition not chametz. So if you have any non-chewable pills, if it's very easy to get a substitute that you're sure is chametz free, then go for it. But what I tell people and what the OU position is that any non-chewable pills are permitted for Pesach. Why? Number one, they're inedible. They're nifsala achilas kelev. They're inedible, and therefore, by definition, they're not chametz. And number two is that you're ingesting it in an unusual way. You're not even eating it in a regular way. You're just swallowing it whole. And so for those two reasons, non-chewable pills are fine. And similarly, creams and deodorants and soaps and these kinds of things are all okay. So look, if you want to check Star K or Blumenkrantz or a Bessin, they'll give you the products listing. That's all according to the stringent position that if there's chametz in there, that's a problem, even if the thing is inedible. And there is such a position, but I think the majority opinion, what I advise people is that all these things are fine. Deodorants, creams, and non-chewable pills, as I said, that these are all fine because they're all inedible. Lipstick, you want to cut off the end or buy a new lipstick because, that's going to, maybe it has like a little food on it or whatever. And anything that's edible, like liquid medicines or chewable items, those are edible. And so then that's a whole different story. And then you should really check to make sure that those are chametz free. The other thing that I wanted to just touch on quickly was so it's a nice custom to try to have chametz free toiletries, but again, that anything that's inedible is by definition not chametz. Yeah, there was something else, but I don't remember it now.
Medicines, you need that as a refuel. I'm not talking about vitamins, I'm talking about medicine.
Yeah, but you still can't have chametz on Pesach. If there's a sakana, there's a danger to your life, then okay, that overrides all other considerations. But
8 days without one of your medications.
Yes, so then, yeah, that's right. If there's a danger to your life and a person has a serious condition, so then you're allowed to take the medication for that reason. But what I'm sharing with you is, okay, let's say there's a substitute where you can get the medication where it's the same medication, but it doesn't have the chametz ingredient. Do you have to like search for that? What I'm telling you is that any non-chewable pills, it's totally fine. Oh, totally. It's fine. The OU's position is it's totally fine.
And it's good. You don't have to sell those things as part of the mechiras chametz. Okay, so hopefully we've clarified the different requirements for getting your home and kitchen ready for Pesach. Really, there's a concept called lefum tzara agra. According to the effort, is the reward we get. And so hopefully all of you should get reward for preparing for Pesach, but that doesn't mean to go overboard. And I think it's very important as you engage in this mitzvah to do it with happiness, to do it with simcha. And to also remember that the preparation that we put into something, that also has religious value. And there's many sources that teach us this. So it should give you a good feeling when you're preparing for the holiday that you're actually, that you're being rewarded for the preparation and the effort that you're putting into it. And anything that you do above and beyond, so Hashem should show special favor to you. The Gemara says that because we go above and beyond with Hashem, and we bench even if we have a small amount, so Hashem goes above and beyond in His treatment to us. And similarly here, with regards to Pesach, don't go overboard. Don't get carried away. Don't make it too difficult for yourselves. But whatever effort you put into it, lefum tzara agra, you get rewarded for that. And number two, any stringencies that you take and any ways you go above and beyond, Hashem should show favor to you and bless you all with a chag kasher v'sameach. Thank you so much. Thank you.